We are here in the new loft in Denver, overlooking the city, a 360 degree view. It's absolutely beautiful. And we're using this both as a residence, but also as offices for Integral Institute. And you're visiting us, and we wanted to talk a little bit about ethics.
Ethics it is.
And you've given some presentations on it at Integral Institute seminars and workshops, and they're highly rated. But one of the things that struck us as so really rather extraordinary is that we've done a poll with Integral Native listeners, for example, and with others who are interested in these kinds of things. And what we found is we asked Integral Native listeners if we created and had a series on Integral Transformative Practice or Integral Life Practice with a whole series of modules, and we gave a list of various types of modules that people could have, such as relationships, meditation, sex, karma yoga, ethics, cognitive, and so on. What would they most like to see included? What would they think would be most important to include? And we were very surprised by the response, which was that the number one item that they thought should be included was meditation. Number two was ethics. Ahead of sex, ahead of work, ahead of relationships. And it tells us that there's a deep hunger and a deep need for some sort of guidance in ethics, and some sort of capacity to practice an ethical life, a life of how should we live. And I think this hunger for ethics, you and I have reflected on this quite a bit, and I think it comes from a couple of things. And the primary reason is that we're really a culture bereft of any sort of ethical compass right now. And this comes from several causes, I think. One is that we're a therapeutic culture and have been for about 30 years. And the good thing that happened with therapy and general therapeutic endeavors is that people would come in with overly harsh judgments, harsh superego, highly critical of themselves, too much shame, too much guilt. And the therapist's job was to help undo that harsh judgment, the harsh guilt, the harsh shame. But we went from having no harsh judgments to have no judgments at all. And so we decommissioned the harsh judgment component, but we tore down the judgment component as well. A certain baby got thrown in that bathwater. While that was happening on a culture-wide scale, in the universities and academies, basically postmodern pluralism was moving into the humanities. And the basic premise there is that no particular value structure is better than another. There's no intrinsic merit to one over another. And under those circumstances, when you ask the academy what's the better thing to do and how can we legitimate saying something is better than something else, I mean, a choice to do this because this is good and that's not good, the academy basically said you can't do that. We have nothing to tell them. At least an extreme postmodernism, postmodern pluralism, didn't help people make ethical judgments. Mm-hmm. And that's, to sort of finish the overall quick gestalt here, what that basically did was decommission people's capacity for ethical judgment. And then there was even a misunderstanding of certain parts of the great mystical traditions of what choiceless awareness meant. And choiceless awareness doesn't mean make no judgment. It means be aware of that which makes judgments and no judgments. In other words, to not make judgments is just as dualistic as making judgments. And there's a witness of both of those. And choiceless meant neither choice nor no choosing. And somehow we turned that into don't make choices either. And so the net effect of at least these three different ways and streams of input into this was our moral compass, our ethical compass, got broken pretty badly, decommissioned over the past 30 years. Years and people are just really desperate for some sort of ethical guidelines. The great traditions, of course, have ethical foundations, and that means that basically the only available source in this culture for ethics has been the fundamentalist ethic, religious doctrine, whether it's the Ten Commandments or family values or what is sometimes unfairly portrayed as the merely Republican approach. But certainly the fundamentalist family values, traditional values, is a value structure that's very absolutistic, and it's one of the main defining characteristics of this kind of ethics, is that it doesn't really take perspectives into account. It's not situational and contextual, even though you can have universal contextual judgments, these make just absolutistic judgments. And so they're very, very simplistic in that sense. And that really was about the only alternative people had to an ethical compass. And so it was a throwback, almost a regression to traditional value structure. So what we're here to talk about is given the paucity and the vacuum of ethical judgments, it's not surprising then that people, on the one hand, have asked us to develop ethical modules. And on the other hand, that your work in a, you might call it post-postmodern ethics, has got such a good reception. And I was remarking to you earlier that there's really very little out there on a post-conventional, truly post-conventional ethics. And so I think even though your work is grounded in the great wisdom traditions, it would not use its sort of metaphysical basis or the kind of traditional value structure that many of them were based on. Even though, again, we can touch bases with them and honor them, but it also has to be reconstructed in the modern and postmodern world, and it's just not very much out there. So I think people are really starving. It's just the worst way.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that's a very nice summary of our contemporary dilemma. And I think it's probably useful also to look historically and realize that, of course, we're not alone in this in some ways. You've just pointed out very nicely the unique features of our own historical time, but the big picture is, of course, this has been one of the most difficult questions. You know, the what should I do has been one of the most difficult existential questions that every human being has wrestled with since time began. And I think of Confucius with his statement, his weeping that, quotes, rare are those who understand virtue. So Confucius was upset about it 2,500 years ago. So in some way, things haven't changed a lot. Although, as you point out, there are a number of unique features in our own time. And of course, each generation or each era has to recreate these in a manner appropriate for its own time. In a way, we're called, I think what you're doing is you're calling us to be Gnostic intermediaries of our own time. Traditionally, a Gnostic intermediary was someone who translated a wisdom tradition from one culture to another. And that requires three things. One is imbibing a wisdom. Second is learning the language and concepts of the culture and community you're trying to communicate to. And third, being able to mesh the two in a creative way so as to create an aha experience. But as you pointed out so cogently in your writing, we're facing a unique time, not only with a meeting of cultures, but a transition across eras, which we've never had to deal with before. And I think you're right. There's been very, very little thought yet about the call for what is required of us as Gnostic intermediaries to bring a contemporary or post-postmodern ethics to birth that in the world. So I would agree completely, and you've named some of the problems or challenges we face, and I think we can probably get into each of those. Let's just take one. You mentioned psychotherapy with its therapeutic concern with judgment and condemnation. But even in that, there's a misunderstanding of judgment. There's been a conflation of two uses of the term. One is judgment as condemnation. The other is judgment as discernment.
Right.
And they've both got the thrown out.
Yeah, the baby with the bathwater, big time on that.
Yeah. And then this the issue which you pointed to, the developmental one, that ethics was framed in an agrarian time for a people in a mythic worldview.
Right.
But that is not going to serve either to constrain behavior or to move people to higher levels, which is one of the real functions of ethics. And I would think if there's one there are several tragic misunderstandings of ethics, but one of them is that ethics has been viewed as a system purely of telling people what to do. It's kind of a mythic level, as opposed to the more contemplative perspective of ethics as mind training, as a fundamental, absolutely essential process and training for helping to foster health and maturation to spiritual levels.
Yeah.
One looks in vain for an understanding in our culture of that.
Yeah.
And other ways in which ethics are misunderstood that create so much suffering. I think, for example, that most of the people in our culture really view ethics as a system of shoulds, in which it's basically a way of avoiding punishment. It's, you know, a very low level in terms of, say, Kohlberg's moral development scale. There's no understanding of the possibilities that ethical living can be and does become an enlightened self-interest. One does it after one appreciates what it's really about. One does it because you realize that you have a better life.
Yeah.
And people around you have a better life.
Yeah.
And that's worth doing.
That's something we want to come back to as well, is what I call ethics in the grain of the cosmos. In other words, that there's one way of looking at ethics as that which facilitates eros, that which fits with the unfolding of the cosmos.
Yes.
And therefore, it is going to be better in that sense. And we'll come back to this in terms of legitimating ethics. How do we actually say, what gives you the right to say this is better than that? And that's really what it comes down to in our culture. We're in a judgment-free zone.
Mm-hmm.
And under that case, coming up with legitimating reasons for ethics becomes all the harder. I think that's one of the reasons people are really looking for ethical guidance. Once they get outside of the traditional values, the Dr. Laura Nazi therapies.
Attack therapy.
But again, people were starting for Dr. Laura because she at least had answers.
Yes.
That this is right, that's wrong, don't do this, do that.
Yes.
For a lot of people in therapy, some 20, 30, 40, 50% of therapy is getting up to the stage of just assuming a conventional level of responsibility for your pre-conventional impulses.
Yeah.
And so people were hungry for that. We've got to go post-conventional in the other direction, yeah. And not really that.
Yeah, and you're pointing to a very important dynamic, and that is the intolerance of ambiguity.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the hallmarks of psychological health is a tolerance of ambiguity. And definitely as one begins to move to a post-conventional stages, one necessarily calls into question and moves beyond the shoulds and givens of the culture. And that does throw one into ambiguity.
Yeah.
And that's painful and difficult. And so Dr. Laura, who says this is the way it is and this is the way it should be, is kind of salvation.
Yeah. Well, you started mentioning some of the developmental aspects of ethics, and you mentioned Kohlberg, and you just mentioned as well the idea that tolerance of ambiguity is a mark of maturation, developmental maturation. And if you look at, for example, Claire Graves, some of the phrases that he used for some of the stages of values development, I think it's very telling, because you can see this sort of increasing tolerance of ambiguity is an increasing number of perspectives that come into play. And as you know, one of the defining characteristics I believe in development, and many developmentalists agree, is the development is marked by the number of perspectives you can take into account. So the more perspectives you can take into account, the higher the levels or stages of development that you're at. And Claire Graves, looking at five of the main levels of development, going from one of the earliest, which she called egocentric, then the next one, which we've been referring to as mythic membership, and it's a conformist level of development, it's traditional values. He called it absolutistic, which is very interesting. And he also called it saintly, only in the sense of the Ten Commandments kind of thing. You must do this as a should, and that's just a second-person perspective. It doesn't take into contextual account other perspectives. So absolutistic is a very, very, this is absolutely right, this is absolutely wrong, it's very, very black or white, good versus evil. And that's the traditional value structure that so many people are falling back on, when the other ones that have more ambiguity, you know, are harder to hold on to sometimes. There's a tendency to fall back to this absolutistic level. Just tell me what's right and what's wrong. How should I behave? You should behave this way. What's the legitimation for this stage? God tells me to do it. I have a book from God, and it's absolutely true, and the legitimating sanction for this is God. And so legitimating morals and ethics becomes a problem only when you move to the stages beyond that, and there's the death of God. Now you have to legitimize morals when you don't have God. In other words, if God is dead, then is everything okay? So moving to the next stage, which was egoic rational, some people think it is scientific, progressive, and so on. Clark has actually called that multiplicity. And that's because for the first time, multiple perspectives start to be taken into account. The level believes that there are many ways to see things. There's one best way to arrive at an answer, that's through science. But it's still a multiplicity. When you move to the next level, sometimes referred to as postmodern or green, in spiral dynamics, for example, it's Keller is referred to that as relativism. So you've gone from multiples to relativistic. There's no way to say which one is right. And this relativistic view is also generally the driving force behind much postmodernism and extreme pluralism. So that all of a sudden you're now released in a world where you can take many perspectives but you cannot integrate them. And so you can't say that one of them is right or one of them is wrong. And so the advantage is you're taking these other perspectives into account. The disadvantage is you're hard-pressed to come up with an ethical response to anything. And so where for the absolutistic level, the mythic level, you do something is ethical because God tells you to do it. On the rational level, something is ethical because reason tells me to do it. Kind of Immanuel Kant, my autonomous reason tells me this thing to do. When you get to relativistic, green, postmodern, the ethics is usually interpreted as nothing but taste. So it's just you're doing it because it's a matter of cultural taste or life fashions. There's no real reason to do it. And again, that's why you get pretty much cut loose at that stage. The next stage, though, beyond relativistic, Clark Gray's called systemic or systematic. And that's where the multiple and relativistic perspectives are starting to be stitched together, start to be unified. The commonalities and the underlying patterns over space and time, over history and cultures, that unite these various perspectives start to come into view. And so there you get universals on a higher level, good enough universals, not the rigid, rationalistic, monolithic universals, but universal patterns that connect. And at this point, the forms of integral theories tend to come into focus. One of the reasons that, then you say, what's the ethical reason to do something there? And I'm going to save the answer to that when we talk about integralism and what that is, because that's where I think it's very interesting. What we want to toss in is one other source of legitimation. As we talked about, the traditional source is God, the rational source is reason, the postmodern source is taste, and the integral source, well, we're going to say tries to integrate those, but we'll get to more in detailed answer in a minute. But another one has always been spiritual, not conceived as mythic commandments. That's the absolutistic. But the spiritual in the sense of meditative states of realization. And when Gautama Buddha was asked in this regard, why should a person do this particular ethical act? He said, because of nirvana. So not because of God, not because of nature, not because of reason, not because of evolution, but because of nirvana. Because of nirvana meant that these ethical actions, whatever else they might be, are actions conducive to realization. Mm-hmm. Which is exactly, in a sense, one of the things you're talking about. And that's one of the things we want to put into the mixture of why should I behave ethically? What should I do? Well, take up some of these actions because they are conducive to your own self-realization, to your own self-awakening, to getting off the wheel of suffering. And so that's another thing that we want to throw into the mix. And we can just call that the spiritual, just referring in this case, the spiritual states of realization. And I think you would agree with that. One of the reasons to be ethical is because of nirvana.
Yeah, so that's essentially a developmental argument, which, of course, at its actualization or realization argument, which culminates in the response for because of nirvana.
Yeah.
So, yes, one whole rationale for ethical behavior is that it's an optimal fostering of one's own well-being.
Yeah.
Considered either at the current level, translation, or developmentally, transformation even unto unto realization and awakening.
Yeah.
And now, of course, the spiritual would also argue that that is no other than what is also optimally conducive to others, that is the dichotomy between serving others and oneself dissolves the more deeply one is ethical and the deeper one's realization. So that's an interesting resolution of the conundrum that is faced by conventional questions of why be ethical. Is it merely duty? Is it for self? Is it for others? And of course, that dichotomy dissolves as being one goes.
Yeah, and it gets more and more integral in that sense too, because the answer is yes, all of the above.
All of the above. And to begin to pull in what you were pointing to before, it also is intuited to be increasingly in line with the grain of the cosmos.
Yeah.
That is, it's natural law has a bad name these days, but I think one can make a good argument for natural ethics.
Yeah,
and we're getting close to that.
And natural law is a good example of why we have to continue to just tweak some very, very good ideas that can no longer be believed in precisely their original form, but they still have a great deal of truth to them if it redone. And, of course, things like the great chain of being and so on are ideas that are no longer really believed in their original forms, but there's an enormous amount of important truth to the general concept, and so we always want to rework those. And natural law is a fine example that there are the natural law, first natural law theorists were ones that were coming out of the great mythic traditions, and so they were attempting to find rationales for why do ethics, what is the good, what is the true, what is the beautiful, if God didn't give them all to us, if they're not all given by some book. And looking at the natural world, they found certain regularities and laws of nature and so on that were then taken to be exemplars of the fact that there could be a natural law, that there could be things we could read from the world around us and not necessarily give it to us from some transcendental God. But the way nature was set up then was as a sort of fixed system or with very fixed Newtonian laws. And we know now that it's just much more fluid and flowing, and the laws are probably more like cosmic habits. So we can still see a directionality of unfolding in the cosmos. And one of the legitimating sources for ethics is, why do it? Because God tells me so? No. Because reason tells me so? No. Because evolution tells me so. In other words, I can read a directionality and eros to evolution. There might be an ethics in that. In other words, go in the direction of increasing development and evolution. That might be a good thing. So that's one of the sources of legitimation that's sometimes brought in. That's a version of natural law updated, in a sense. A morphogenetic field that's tilting towards the greater good. And so that's a version that doesn't necessarily believe in the original form of natural law, a kind of an updated version.
Yeah, and there's another legitimizing source, which is actually the one that I find myself drawing on most, both for myself and in the teaching and work I do around this area of ethics. And that is that I think the grounding and legitimizing factor is that if we look into our own experience, particularly if we look with a little bit of contemplative meditative training so that we've sensitized our awareness, we're a little more sensitive to the way our mind works, then we find a very, very important thing, and that is that when we're ethical, our minds function better, and they function better in all sorts of ways. From going back to your point about practice for nirvana, they function in ways that optimize development. If, when we're ethical, they function in ways which make for greater happiness. And they function in ways which cultivate a spectrum of psychologically healthy and spiritually beneficent qualities. And so what is most compelling for me, and I think is what I feel most comfortable in suggesting to people, is that none of this has to be taken on either faith or even on a theoretical basis, but rather can be done, as with all good contemplative practices, as a self-experiment.
Yeah.
And that we have and we are the laboratory in which we can investigate this for ourselves.
You have a wonderful phrase, too, that talks about an essentially similar thing, which is feeling good by doing good, which is a similar kind of thing in this case, which is after you look, you sort of check this thing out, one of the ways you're going to check it out is just that. You're going to find you function better, you feel better, you unfold better. And so the taste indeed is right there for you to experience.
Yeah, and that's such a wonderful discovery, because so much of our cultural understanding of ethics is based on the understanding that ethics is fundamentally self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
And, okay, you do what's good, but it never really feels good. But it is such a wonderful discovery to find that actually ethical living feels good and makes other people feel good. It's something we want to do
yeah.
once you begin to really understand
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And then the self-sacrifice element just drops out.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point because it also ties in with the developmental view, which is that in some sense, ethics is that which helps us move to higher levels of development, to higher levels of consciousness, to higher, deeper dimensions of our own being. And that's why I think it's very interesting. There is an inherent, in my view, connection between ethics and eros. Mm-hmm. Because eros means at least a couple of things. One, it's the grain of the cosmos. It's the direction towards greater wholeness that the universe seems to be moving towards. And not in the sense of moving towards the mega point. I really don't think it's doing mm-hmm. that. Just in the sense that it continually drives to go beyond what went before. There's levels of increasing complexity, levels of increasing consciousness, and that's the eros, that's the grain of the cosmos. And acting in accord with that grain is ethical. That's one definition of ethics. Mm-hmm. Why should I do it? Because that's the direction that the universe is headed. So get with the program. And that's, or else you're not going to get with your own higher unfolding or unfolding in general. That's only part of an integral ethics, but I think it's an important part to consider. The evolutionary developmental component seems to have a normative association with it. I can say, what should I do? Why can you say that one set of behaviors is better than another? Well, because we find that when we study these unfolding levels or stages of development, some are higher than others. People move in these directions towards higher stages. They don't move in the reverse direction. And you can't alter the order by environmental or social conditioning. So these higher stages seem to be better. So if you look at Carol Gilligan's simple three or four stages of female ethical development, she called them selfish, care, universal care, and integrated. So selfish is egocentric, care is ethnocentric, universal care is world-centric, and integrated is integrating all of them, or what we would call cosmocentric. Is it better to be world-centric than ethnocentric? Yes, it is. Why? Well, according to this argument, because it's a higher stage of development. And that's better, first of all, because that's what the universe is doing. That's the direction it's going. But also, there's more perspectives taken into account at world-centric than at ethnocentric. And so as an independent line of argument, we would say the more perspectives you take into account in making a decision, the more ethical that decision is attempting to be. Because you're intending and can intend the well-being of more sentient beings, including yourself. You can't do it if you can't take their perspective into account. So an ethical impulse cannot be ethical according even to your definition. The intention can't be, unless you can take their perspectives into account.
Mm-hmm.
So since development is increasing number of perspectives, then there's a directionality, a normative directionality. I mean, we can actually say world-centric is better than ethnocentric, which is better than egocentric. And egocentric meaning only a first-person perspective, not that you are also taking yourself into account. So ethnocentric means first plus second-person perspectives are included. World-centric means first plus second plus third and so on. So you're not leaving yourself out of the equation. It's supposed to appear at all of them. The egocentric means the person that takes only the ego into account. So that's another example in that sense of eros as directionality to the cosmos and ethics. And the feel-good component is that their eros is also, it's always been understood that eros is deeply sexual in some sense. And one of the reasons, or that to be more accurate, sexuality is a manifestation of eros at, it turns out, a somewhat lower level, but nonetheless, it is there. And the reason that sexuality and eros have often been hooked together, not just by Plato, but Freud, is that sexuality is one of the earliest attempts to make a union, to become one with something else, to reach outside of yourself and unite with it. And so sexuality has always been sort of an exemplar of at least an aspect of eros. And what people are starting to discover, what you're talking about, is that the higher the levels of development, the higher the levels of a certain kind of joy and bliss and feel-good, quote-unquote, that you get. So you actually, ethical behavior can get you to levels of ecstatic, joyful contentment and happiness that just doesn't, again, is completely missed if you think of ethics as nothing but self-denial or self-almost punishment in certain sense, self-deprecation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very poor understanding of ethics to simply say you should not, you should not, you should not. Mm-hmm. Don't drink, don't smoke, don't fuck. That's ethics. That's not ethics. That's brutality. Anyway, so I it's sort of a rift on that whole notion, but I come back time and again to cosmos, logos, ethics, eros. And there's ethics and eros.
Well, there's so much in what you said. You're making me, made me realize a couple of things. One, of course, is that an optimal ethical instructional system will be able to speak across many levels because, you know, we can have this nice conversation about, you know, why be ethical for Nirvana, but that's not exactly going to cut it with a lot of America.
Right.
So even the, you know, don't do this, don't do that, probably is a necessary component. But unfortunately, what's not recognized in our culture is that it's stage specifically appropriate, but beyond that stage, it's stage limited.
Yes.
And so many of these instructions are, and emotions, for example, guilt, which, you know, is the gift which keeps on giving. Guilt is, you know, guilt is probably essential to a certain developmental stage to maintain ethics. But as far as I can see, and I've looked very hard, at a certain level of adulthood, it is, as far as I can see, a primarily destructive and unnecessary emotion. But in our culture, we don't realize that. We have a firm set belief that if there was no guilt, everyone would run amok. And I think that's just, a developmentally, an understanding that lacks a developmental perspective.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think particularly if you look at shame and guilt in the early stages of development, shame is in relation to an other. So I feel shame around, you know, if my mother is present, I'm ashamed. Guilt is internalized shame. Guilt you can feel alone in the closet, and many young boys do. And shame is something that you have to actually be faced by something with. Mm-hmm. So what is so important, as you were suggesting, is shame is very important in helping people restrain impulses at an egocentric level. And part of the difficulties, as you know, in this culture is that we have this sort of conflict. We have a therapeutic culture trying to help people understand that they've had too much shame and too much guilt. But then society at large sometimes going overboard with therapeutic culture, and nobody's ashamed of anything in this culture anymore, which is some particularly conservative critics would make a great deal out of that, too much out of it, of course. But we've lost a certain necessary glue of shame as a background, and that, I think that's part of the overly therapeutic culture.
Right, and that may be quite skillful. The release your shame may be quite skillful advice for a certain developmental stage, but below that,
it's a
problem.
Socially,
So again, this conversation is certainly making me realize just the importance of a developmental perspective on this.
Developmental and the time specific. Once you start thinking developmentally and just add that vertical dimension, the stage appropriateness of things strikes you again and again, and how something is right at one stage is wrong in another. That the God of one stage is the devil of the next, and we see this historically even. And that what's appropriate at one stage, shame and guilt, is absolutely inappropriate at others, and too much of it can really backfire. But then it really sort of tying in one's prescriptions for the particular stage or level is very useful reminders for what's going on.
Yeah, and holding those emotions such as shame or guilt beyond the stage which they're necessary, or acting unethically in a way which induces them, you know, guilt and shame, or any of the other negative emotions which arise as a result of unethical behavior, be it anxiety or fear or worry or whatever, all have a negative function in that they hold one back to one's current developmental level and therefore mitigate against this grain of the cosmos or eros that you're speaking of.
Yes.
That is, lack of ethics ties one to one's current developmental stage.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that it's basically what we tend to find is that, in a sense, there are, and we would get to in a moment, what are actually ethical acts, and talk about some examples of this is ethical and this isn't, and what do we mean? Sure, we can say that the well-being of more and more perspectives and more sentient beings, but give me some examples of what it means to do an ethical act and an unethical act. But what we so often find is we can talk about like the general definition of what ethics is, which can hold true across levels, but then often the manifest examples of that general definition is changes the concrete particulars change, and they're different.
Exactly.
They're different ethical norms at different levels of development, and we have to be careful of that. In other words, be ashamed is a primary injunction for somebody at certain levels. Yes. Really, you should be ashamed of that. You should absolutely be ashamed of that. And then at other levels, it can stop you. It can be too much and it's based inappropriate. It can prevent you from moving to higher levels. Mm-hmm. And this sensitivity to vertical dimensions, instead of having a flatline approach, one size fits all, is a very, very important part of ethics and ethics recommendation.
Yeah, I would agree. And you're reminding me of that wonderful line of Muhammad, speak to each person according to their level of understanding.
Who's somebody who probably understood it less than anybody else on the face of the planet, but we'll get back to that later, perhaps.
Well, he was certainly giving an ethical teaching, which was, as you pointed out, necessary for those tribes warring among one another.
That's something
another.
That's truly to keep in mind. Yeah. Some of these things that seem very harsh to us are ethical injunctions necessary with certain stages of development, particularly tribal types of interactions. And so we have to be sensitive to the fact that those make sense under those circumstances, but they don't make sense in other circumstances.
And I think that points to a challenge that comes up whenever we try to do something, as you were just saying, we should get around to, and that is giving specific examples of ethical acts.
Right.
And again, I find myself here thinking again of the importance of different strokes at different levels. For myself, you know, talking to, you know, fairly healthy adults for the most part, because those are the ones who tend to be interested in a conversation of this kind.
Yeah.
You know, if you know the truth or God's given you the truth directly, you don't need to have this conversation.
No, nor if your blood or a crip, even though it's too interesting in a given moment.
Right, exactly. And, so for the people that I find myself talking with and investigating this with, I find myself not giving examples of ethical acts per se, but more giving suggestions for ways by which people can intuit what is ethical in each situation, because that's the appropriate strategy for people at a particular, a fairly mature level.
Great.
That is to be forced back on oneself to recognize that in any given situation, the complexity of any situation, the competing demands are often so much that no one can compute them all. This is, of course, it was what lands one in the perspectival madness of the green level. But still, the way out of that, or one way out, is to recognize that while we cannot compute our way out of it, while we cannot use rationality to think our way out of it, there are capacities, intuitive capacities, contemplative, spiritual, intuitive capacities within us, which can take that as a gestalt, kind of like Aurobindo's intuitive mind, and take the whole, and one feels into what is, there will often just emerge in a sense of the appropriateness and rightness of action in any moment.
Let's talk about that then. Let's just go into it right now in terms of some of these kinds of rules of thumb or guidelines for ethical behavior. And let's just talk about that for a little bit. And you just mentioned generally giving people pointers for ways that they can intuit that aspect of themselves, the higher or highest aspects of themselves, that in a sense already has an intuitive feel for what the ethical thing is to do. And so let's just give a couple of examples or talk a little bit about this to flesh it out.
Okay, well, I think that it's important to, in my own mind, I find important to recognize that here we're dealing with the development of a particular capacity or faculty.
Yeah.
And as with so many capacities or faculties, it has to be cultivated and trained. And one can do that with two types of practices. One, general practices, which foster developmental maturation in general.
Yep.
And the other are specific practices, which is specifically aimed at fostering ethical development, that aim at developing a particular faculty. I think it's very important to realize that, in general, You know, as the philosophers have said for centuries, there is a kind of unity of virtues that, to the extent one develops one's virtues in any domain, they tend to pull each other along. And so to the extent one fosters one's own development, well-being, health, maturation, to that extent, ethical development will get be fostered and pulled along with that. And so the first thing for anyone who, I think for anyone who truly wants to foster their own ethical maturation and thereby that of others, is to take up some sort of discipline or practice, and of course in Integral Institute it's been an integral practice, which aims at fostering their own well-being and development.
Right.
So that's the kind of background or foundation, I think. Then there are any number of specific practices one can do for cultivating particularly relevant and related qualities and capacities. The quality, for example, of empathy or compassion.
Yeah.
Or the exercises for doing what I call experimental ethics. That is, do something, things as simple as do a good deed and see how you feel.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to really observe how you feel about after you do something something nice.
And you ask somebody to do something like that, and again, you're just going to let them sort of decide what a good deed is. Most people have a general idea of what general good deeds are, but again, as you know, we will talk about this in a moment, actually defining the good in detail is hard. But that's simple enough right now. So people go out and actually do a good deed as an experiment, and well, people know this. You really feel good when you do it. It's like feeling good by doing good.
Except but our culture doesn't seem to know
this
as a whole.
Doesn't seem to know that,
I mean, you said yes, and I would agree, yes, people know that as individual, but somehow it doesn't seem to be.
Well, it's two different kinds of knowing. In other words, if you actually ask somebody to remember the last time they did a good deed, they'll probably remember feeling real good after it, generally. You're right, the culture treats it as if, you know, the only thing that's doing good is somehow a grunt and groan and difficult self-sacrifice.
Exactly.
And as a higher form of hedonism, ethics is not understood as that, but it is. As we're talking, it's a higher form of eros.
Hedonism, that's an interesting phrase, yes.
And that's, I'm all for hedonism, and therefore you try to be as ethical as possible, because I want more of it. And that's exactly...
Well, I have to say that Joseph Campbell's injunction, follow your bliss, just becomes deeper and more meaningful to
as me. Right, but you were the person we've been, we would qualify that by saying your bliss has to take into account the perspectives of others.
Yes.
And because you could follow your bliss at merely an egocentric level. There's an egocentric bliss, there's an ethnocentric bliss, there's a world-centric bliss, etc. And that's
well, this may be a little bit of diversion, but is there an egocentric bliss? Not just happiness. Happiness.
Okay, let's put it this way now. If bliss is a state, then you can get into a state even if you're in an egocentric stage. And sometimes states tend to reinforce the stage you're at. This is what we, how I would say. So we have to be careful about, as you know, just following your bliss in that sense can be, I'm just going to go out and after all, people are going to follow your bliss. Means they're going to follow whatever bliss they have available to them. So,
It's certainly liable to misunderstanding, that's for sure.
Yeah.
No question.
But we're qualifying it in a way that Joseph didn't. And again, I think it's a wonderful phrase, and it certainly caught on, but it caught on for a lower hedonistic abuse, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really qualify the notion of levels of bliss or levels of hedonism. That's my nitpicking on it.